Thanks for tuning in for the December 1st podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's feature interview focuses on the diagnostic criteria for idiopathic sensory polyneuropathy. For our What's Trending segment, you'll hear an interview with Dr. Justin MacArthur, who was elected to the National Academy of Medicine this year. Please remember that we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
This is Stacey Clardy from the Salt Lake City VA and the University of Utah, and today I'm speaking with Roy Freeman from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Thanks, Roy, for joining us for the podcast.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So, Roy, you've done a ton of meaningful research in a lot of areas of peripheral and autonomic neurology, especially. I'm most familiar with your work on both typical and atypical neuropathies related to diabetes. But today we're going to talk about your paper in neurology. It's titled Idiopathic Distal Sensory Polyneuropathy, Action Diagnostic Criteria. And ACTION is actually an acronym for the network of clinicians that you work with that put together these diagnostic criteria. It's a mouthful, so I see why your group made it into an acronym. It stands for Analgesic, Anesthetic, and Addiction Clinical Trial Translations, Innovations, Opportunities, and Networks. And you can tell us more what that stands for as we get into the discussion. But from what I gather, the goal here was to standardize the diagnosis of distal sensory neuropathies and to help clinicians better parse them out into categories so we can ultimately better treat the causes and study the causes. So can you tell us about the three types and try to bring it down a notch for me a little bit here? I'm more of a CNS neurologist, but certainly we all see loads of neuropathies, whether isolated or in conjunction with other symptoms. So before we get into the nitty-gritty, can you back up and make sure I'm even using the correct terms when I talk about neuropathy? So for example, the term polyneuropathy is really what we think of as a standard peripheral neuropathy, right?
Yes, that's correct. A polyneuropathy usually has the preface generalized before it. And for those who are not peripheral nerve aficionados, we divide the peripheral neuropathies into two very clear and different classes, the generalized polyneuropathies, and those are typically symmetrical. On the other side of the coin are the asymmetric neuropathies, and these are focal or multifocal. The reason why this classification is so important is because it points you in a very different direction as far as trying to delineate specific etiologies. And the focal asymmetrical are typically ischemic, compressive, vasculitic, which takes one down a very different path to the generalized polyneuropathies, the symmetrical polyneuropathies, which are likely to be toxic or metabolic or having a systemic cause.
Okay, I think I've got it. So, you know, really it's differentiating mononeuropathy from polyneuropathy. And then you even started to get into symmetric versus asymmetric. So if I understand correctly, if more than one nerve is involved, so it's a polyneuropathy, not a mononeuropathy, and perhaps the most highly prevalent bilateral peripheral neuropathy in the feet that we see often in clinic would qualify as a distal sensory polyneuropathy. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So if we think of the asymmetric neuropathies, the focal or multifocal, these are either mononeuropathies or mononeuritis multiplex. And there is a little warning, and I know the audience is probably highly clinical, that in a severe mononeuritis multiplex, one can have confluent lesions and it can mimic a generalized symmetrical polyneuropathy. And there, typically, the progression of the neuropathy is what is of importance.
That's an important pearl that you raised. That's a great point. And so back to your paper, you're focusing on classifying the idiopathic distal sensory polyneuropathies, right? So the ones of a known cause, like a diabetes contributing or a genetic contribution, you're not talking about those in the paper, correct?
Yes and no. And perhaps now's a good time to step back to ACTION and that mouthful. What ACTION is in fact a partnership between the government, the FDA and the NIH, industry, and academia. And not even academia, because certainly at this meeting, there were a number of participants who were in private practice. And the basis of this project was essentially to do that, to improve the diagnosis, to improve research, and to improve treatment. And that is the basis of this classification, this taxonomy. There were two factors that played a role in the development of this classification. The first is the realization that there is a group, a relatively small group, but a group of small fiber sensory neuropathies that have a polymorphism underlying them, a polymorphism in the genes that encode for sodium channels, specific sodium channels, NaV1.7, NaV1.8, and NaV1.9, which raises the exciting possibility that there may be personalized treatments for these peripheral neuropathies, specific sodium channel blockers that may actually affect individual peripheral neuropathies for which we have a cause. Now, in preparation for these meetings, we typically do a systematic review on the topic, and it was really apparent that the approach, the classification, the taxonomy of these small fiber neuropathies in a variety of studies, there was a wide divergence in the different classifications, and those two factors prompted the initiation of the meeting. At the meeting, we also recognized the most prevalent of the neuropathies have no cause. And depending on the literature that you read, it can be up to 50%, perhaps even more. We all know that that group of peripheral neuropathies are not well studied and have no treatment. And the hope was that by looking at these idiopathic sensory peripheral neuropathies, the highly prevalent peripheral neuropathies that we see all the time, that by attempting to provide a very clear taxonomy, we could stimulate research, epidemiological research, clinical research, and therapeutics into this territory. And that really was what underlay the development of these criteria.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. But what I also hear you saying, because I tried to pin you down and say, okay, so we're talking about the ones where we don't know the cause, so we would be excluding diabetes and genetic. And maybe what I hear you saying is, no, we can't make it that oversimplified because, in fact, many of these idiopathic ones may have a genetic underpinning. Is that right?
That's exactly right. What is idiopathic and how extensive, how expensive a workup needs to be done before we can actually say that this individual has an idiopathic peripheral neuropathy? As a first line, I think still most of us will follow the AAN guidance, which is now probably 10 years old, where the first line investigations are to make sure there's not impaired glucose tolerance, to make sure there's not a B12 deficiency, and make sure there's not a paraproteinemia. The next step would be in the definition of what is and is not idiopathic is probably guided by where the clinical history and clinical examination take you. Dry eyes, dry mouth will precipitate the search for Sjogren's syndrome, anti-Rho, anti-La antibodies, weight loss, perhaps for a paraneoplastic neuropathy, and so on.
That's a great summary. I imagine there was some heated debate at this meeting. You did, though, you know, we have the paper and the group managed to come up with three main categories. And now that I have a better understanding of what we're tackling here, can you walk us through those three categories? And I think it's pretty clear it will impact research, but also tell us how that might impact my patients today.
The theory is that there are different populations of nerve fibers and they are going to be affected in different ways by different diseases. For example, the small fiber neuropathy will typically have pain and will have autonomic features. Now, they may not always have autonomic features. They may merely have pain. And I do want to emphasize that this classification scheme doesn't go into depth about the autonomic aspects of it. But the small fiber neuropathies, the deficits are going to be in pain and temperature sensation. The symptoms are going to be related to spontaneous pain or evoked pain, which is to say hyperalgesia, a painful stimulus, will feel even more painful. Think of testing pin on somebody who has a peripheral neuropathy, and often you have that exaggerated response, hyperalgesia, or allodynia, pain in response to a non-painful stimulus. Think of a warm shower on sunburnt skin after a day in the sun. And that's allodynia. So those are the typical signs and symptoms that one might see in a small fiber neuropathy. Whereas in a large fiber neuropathy, it's going to be loss of the large fiber modalities on examination, position and vibration. And the complaints will be more of so-called negative symptoms, loss of sensation, perhaps distorted sensation, complaints of numbness. Then subdivide the special investigations into those that address small fiber. And we decided that the gold standard for the assessment of the small nerve fibers was the intraepidermal nerve fiber density assessment, whereas the gold standard for the assessment of the large fibers was nerve conductions. So I think what I want to convey is that the classification is driven by the typical clinical approach that a peripheral nerve aficionado would have in approaching the patient, and that really provides the basis for the assessment of any patient who has a peripheral neuropathy.
In a patient whom you're clinically convinced has a small fiber neuropathy, do you always go for the biopsy?
Definitely not. And there are a number of reasons for that. Possibly the most important point is that many times one can have the symptoms of a small fiber neuropathy due to changes in nerve physiology. So patients may have pain and allodynia before there are pathological changes. In research studies, ideally, you want confirmation with either a physiological test, nerve conduction studies, or a pathologic test, the intraepidermal nerve fiber densities, to be specific as far as the criteria go.
That's very useful. And certainly in clinic, we do find patients where we're so convinced. And if there's not a currently available research study and the symptom control is good, I have opted out of it. So it's good to hear that that's an okay choice in certain situations and certainly when it's not research-based. Are there any other clinical tips you've found successful in managing and treating patients with distal sensory neuropathy, or even better for someone like me, any pitfalls? For example, any serologic markers we should be checking or we should stop checking in certain circumstances?
I'll answer this from the perspective of somebody who sees patients who are referred for second opinions, and what are the most common areas where I feel that we've contributed to the care. The vast majority of times I find that the workup has been exemplary and I have very little to contribute to patient care. Some of the areas where I think things are missed, sometimes it makes a difference, sometimes it doesn't, is a careful history about potential toxic exposure, a careful family history. The history should delineate the direction of the workup. So weight loss, paraneoplastic, gastrointestinal symptoms, look for possible celiac disease. The possibility of a collagen vascular disease needs to be explored in the setting of dry eyes, dry mouth, joint symptoms. So I think that the history should dictate the depth of the workup. We need to pay particular attention to where uncovering a cause of a neuropathy is going to make a major difference. And I think we are living in a very exciting time of neurotherapeutics. Perhaps the most exciting is what is happening in the field of the peripheral neuropathy associated with hereditary amyloidosis, previously called familial amyloid polyneuropathy. And I think it's remarkable how that field has changed in a couple of years, where a disease which was rapidly progressive and universally fatal now has two treatments which substantially improve quality of life.
This is incredibly informative. I really appreciate you taking the time, not just to update us on these criteria, but really to give us a primer on updated approach to neuropathies and things not to miss. The treatment implications are exciting. The full paper, again, is in Neurology. It's available online now. It's titled Idiopathic Distal Sensory Polyneuropathy: Action Diagnostic Criteria. Thanks so much for joining us. Hi, this is Stacey Clardy from the Salt Lake City VA and University of Utah. Today, I'm speaking with Justin MacArthur. He's the chair of neurology at Johns Hopkins and also the current president of the ANA, the American Neurological Association. He was just recently elected to the National Academy of Medicine. He's one of two neurologists who was elected this year to the Academy of Medicine, the other being Merit Kudowitz. It's a fantastic accomplishment to be elected. And so here at the podcast, we really wanted to talk a bit with Justin about how he came to realize this success. So Justin, first of all, congratulations and thank you for taking the time to talk.
Well, thank you. It's really my pleasure to be here today.
So Justin, you've done quite a bit of research in many areas, most significantly neuroinfectious disease and neuroimmunology. So I want to start with your work on HIV. How did you find yourself doing research in that area?
Well, it was, like many things in life, serendipity. I was just finishing neurology residency here in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins. And in 1984, in the last year of my residency, we had our first patient with HIV. We were a couple of years behind the East and West Coasts, New York and San Francisco. And I just became fascinated by this, you know, of course, new disease at the time. No one had ever seen anything quite like it. It was in many ways a terrifying time because patients were dying left and right with bizarre neurological complications, toxoplasmosis, brain abscesses, HIV dementia. They were developing spastic paraparesis from HIV-associated myelopathy. So it was really a pretty amazing experience, first learning to take care of these patients, and second, designing research studies that allowed us to define the epidemiology and then the pathobiology of some of these complications.
Was there anything particularly surprising from the research you did at that time? You know, for example, the most surprising finding you've had in your research career, was it related to HIV or another area of research?
Well, there were surprises all along the way. I think the biggest surprise was in the early years, we were studying spinal fluid in patients with HIV infection. And actually, my wife was working with me at the time as a research coordinator on this study. And we would have a Saturday clinic for HIV positive men in our studies. And they would come in every 6 months and volunteer to have a lumbar puncture. So first, it strikes me thinking back on those days, just how altruistic those research volunteers were. And what we found, and this was quite a surprise, was that a large proportion, perhaps as many as 70% of individuals within the first 6 to 12 months of acquiring HIV infection had abnormalities in their spinal fluid. Basically, they had, in many cases, an asymptomatic meningitis caused, of course, by HIV.
So was that work in HIV, was that the most exciting project you say you've ever been involved in so far over your career, or anything else that you found particularly exciting?
There's so many things that were exciting. Learning new things and designing new studies, writing new grants is always exciting, especially if they get funded. But I think the part of my HIV research that I've enjoyed the most is really focused on therapeutics. And beginning in the 1990s, a number of investigators around the country collaborated to form essentially a trials network led by David Clifford at Washington University in St. Louis, to pool together resources and develop, design, and conduct clinical trials for neurological manifestations. And that was probably one of the most exciting things to do, to collaborate with other investigators, to design things together, to pool resources, and to really push therapeutics for people living with HIV/AIDS. And it was a tremendously productive time for all of us. And I think we had a big impact on people's lives and in many cases helped improve therapeutic management of these patients.
So I think what I hear you saying is the HIV research was, continues to be incredibly rewarding, but another area for you that really took it to the next level was being able to coordinate this on an even larger scale. Is that fair?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, all of us who are physicians, physician scientists, want to have an impact on our patients' health. And the most direct route to having an impact is obviously through therapeutics. And so I think that aspect of my research has really been most meaningful to me.
Yeah, certainly. And what was that clinical trials network called?
So it was within the AIDS Clinical Trials Group, which is one of the largest clinical trials networks in the country. And nested within it, we had a sort of a neurological group.
Yeah. And it sounds like that sort of work specific to HIV and AIDS was maybe the predecessor for some of the larger programs that NIH sponsors now. I don't want to sort of be rewriting history, but it's sounding like things that I've heard of more recently, like Neuronext and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think at the time, you know, there were large national or even international clinical trial groups. obviously, stroke trials were done in a multinational, multi-institutional manner, and that led to things like the Parkinson's Study Group, which was doing very well-designed trials for Parkinson's disease and Parkinsonian syndromes. But the HIV group, I think, came along and, you know, in some ways was a forerunner for things like StrokeNet and SIREN.
Wow. Yeah, that's fascinating. So that's the 1990s you've taken us up through. So what's your most exciting project right now?
Well, we've continued our work in therapeutics. We're fortunate we have had an NIMH-funded center for HIV-associated neurocognitive disorders here for almost 20 years. And that studies that we've done have included animal work looking at developing a mouse model for HIV in the brain. We've done pathobiology studies using human tissues, both brain and peripheral nerve. And we've continued our work in therapeutics, and we actually just finished an intranasal insulin trial for HIV-associated neurocognitive disorder, which I'm very excited to see the results in a few weeks.
Oh, wow, that is exciting. That's fantastic. You know, I don't want to focus entirely on your research because you've done so much more. So you're a member of the National Academy of Medicine, and like many members there, your research has had a profound impact. But you're also a chair, as we said at the beginning, and a clinician, and that's not really all. But now framing this around being elected to be a National Academy of Medicine member, what are you going to do next? What projects will encompass the mission of that organization?
Well, I think some of the work that we've begun through the American Neurological Association and here at Johns Hopkins, focusing on social justice issues and issues related to diversity, inclusion, and equity. I mean, I've been involved in these to some extent throughout my career, but obviously the events of the last year, both the pandemic and some of the tragic episodes where people of color have been brutalized within our society, have really woken me and many others within the American Neurological Association to try to transform our organization and the lives of our patients and our members. What we've done in the last 6 to 12 months is embark on really a process of education, self-education, and teaching each other about structural racism and about issues relating to diversity and inclusion. And now we've set up a task force within the ANA headed by Allison Willis and Leslie Scolaris called the Ideas Task Force. We borrowed the name shamelessly from the University of Rochester, and Ideas stands for Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, Anti-Racism, and Social Justice. And we'll be using this as a platform to create actionable items, actionable steps that we can take both within the ANA and within our academic homes, within our home departments. And we really want this to focus more broadly than just on issues of anti-racism and develop vehicles and steps that can be taken to improve diversity and inclusion, really for all segments of our membership and our faculties, including members and faculty of color and individuals with disabilities and individuals from a diverse background.
What I hear you're saying, too, is that this is going to go forward indefinitely. I don't hear you saying we've done X and Y and we're done. And so it's really encouraging to hear that you're going to be pushing this forward, that this is a major focus for you in the future.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This needs to be a durable and a sustainable effort by all of us, frankly, in academic neurology.
I'm sure many of us will be watching closely and are anticipating the action we'll see coming out of this. So switching gears a little bit, do you have any wisdom to share with us as it relates to clinic and those starting research careers?
I think it's very important for those of us who are physician scientists. The first part of that phrase, physician scientist, is very important to me. I am still very active clinically. In fact, I'm probably busier now clinically than I've ever been at any point in my career. And I love that. I like providing care. I like helping people. You know, in my core, that's what I went to medical school for. And so that will remain a very important part of what I do. In developing as a leader, you know, now I'm department director and have been in that role for a number of years. You have to change really your focus away from your own career development and research program development to helping other people within your department. And I'm very tuned in to the concept of serving leadership. I think it's extremely important, and it's a principle that I've really tried to follow. I think the other advice that I would give to individuals who are in academic neurology is, and this is advice that I was given by one of my mentors, Guy McCon, who was the founding director of the Department of Neurology here at Johns Hopkins, was to be willing to stretch. Stretch beyond your comfort levels, even if you're not trained as a neuromuscular person, even if you're not trained as a neurocognitive person, even if you don't have a particular skill set. You can still contribute. You can certainly learn the skills that might be necessary to form a research program in a particular area. So stretching, I think, is really important. And finally, and I used this word a few minutes ago, collaboration is not only fun to do, but it's absolutely essential when we're talking about team-based science. You need to be able to collaborate in a way so that everyone is part of the process and can win.
That's great advice. How did you find your collaborators?
I was fortunate. I've been at Hopkins now for 40 years, and Hopkins is an extremely collegial place. And that, frankly, is part of the reason that I've stayed here throughout my career, because people are truly curious, curious about science and curious about therapeutic advancements. But they're also generous with their time. And in terms of helping with your research project or our research project, people want to be collaborative.
I think what I hear you saying is environment is so important. And maybe if a young researcher is into getting that environment, they need to look elsewhere. That doesn't necessarily mean moving, I guess, but going beyond.
No, I think one of the silver linings of the whole COVID pandemic has been how rapidly neurology and medicine writ large has pivoted to using telemedicine, using Zoom, whatever other digital processes to make connections. And I think we've learned very rapidly just how much you can do, even if you're remote. And I'm confident, and in fact, the American Neurological Association has an e-mentoring program that we have seen be particularly helpful and particularly useful during the pandemic, because, you know, people are not able to physically connect. So I think that as a junior faculty member or a junior physician scientist, if you're not getting the career advice and the research advice in your home institution, seek it elsewhere. You can do that remotely now.
So are you one of those e-mentors?
I am one of those e-mentors, and I have several mentees in other departments and have taken a lot of pride in seeing their accomplishments.
Fantastic. You know, now our whole podcast audience knows that you're an e-mentor as well. So, what would you tell a young Justin MacArthur, whether back in the UK, here in the States, earlier in your career, at any point when you were maybe most frustrated, you know, things weren't going your way, what would you tell yourself?
I think probably the most important advice that I could give anybody is to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you and collaborate. That's something I've tried to do throughout my career. I found it incredibly fulfilling to work with people who know things that I don't know. They have taught me innumerable things, both about research and clinical care, that I've been able to use to help patients or help improve research projects. And, you know, ultimately, it has been an extremely fulfilling career.
That's fantastic wisdom. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. And once again, congratulations, an incredible honor. And thank you for representing us neurologists in the National Academy of Medicine.
Well, thank you for having me today. It's been my pleasure.
Please take a look at this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.